The Jewish Heritage Foundation presents The Epic of the Eternal People, an in-depth study of Jewish history based on original source material given by Rav Shmuel Irons, Rosh HaKollel, Dean of the Kollel Institute of Greater Detroit, one of the leading centers of Talmudic research and community education in North America.
This lecture, entitled Twilight in Israel, The Disciples of Rabbi Yochanan and the Completion of the Talmud Yerushalmi, is dedicated to the memory and le'ilui nishmas of Shmuel ben Rabbi Yehuda Leib, Olav HaSholem, Dr. Samuel Mofsis, of blessed memory.
The Talmud, in Brachos in 5a, Hayomad Aleph, quotes a statement of Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai. Sholosh matonos tovos nosna kodesh baruch hu Yisrael. The Holy One, blessed be He, gave Israel three precious gifts. V'chulon lo nitn el al yedei Yisurim. And all of them were only given through suffering. The Torah, the land of Israel, and the world to come. In other words, the cost of greatness in Torah, living in and controlling the land of Israel, and gaining a portion of the world to come, is through sacrifice. It's through suffering. The historic period that produced the Mishnah and Talmud Yerushalmi, the Talmud that was studied and produced in the land of Israel, richly illustrates the truth of Rabbi Shimon's statement. Unlike Bovel, Babylon, whose yeshivas flourished under relatively stable conditions, the Jews in the land of Israel were constantly the subject of harassment and persecution from the Romans. Whole areas that were once heavily populated with Jews, like Tur Malka, for instance, literally it means the Mountain of the King, which was once a major population center. In fact, the Gemara in Gittin, and on Zion Amad Aleph in 57a, describes, probably in great hyperbole, how many different villages, cities, which were heavily populated with Jews, lived on that hill, on that mountain. After, in the wake of the defeat of the Bar Kokhba War in the year 135, the place became totally depopulated of Jews. In fact, the whole southern area of Israel was by and large became an area which was inhospitable to Jews. Jews weren't allowed to visit Yerushalayim. In fact, Jerusalem was converted into a pagan city. In the wake of these conditions, the yeshivas, which prior to the Bar Kokhba rebellion were located in the south, had to move north in the Galilee. And the Galilee was a place which was by and large lacked Torah knowledge. I mean, they were observant, but it was really not a place of Torah. And the rabbis had to go and to move their, they and their students in a relative wilderness. In addition, besides the population, the migrations, the Mishnah at the end of the Tractate Sota points out that after the death of Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel, approximately the year 169, and again after the death of Yehuda Anossi, approximately in the year 192, there were terrible tragedies and upheavals that befell the Jews. And in fact, that was just the beginning. Throughout the entire period of the Talmud Yerushalmi, when the Talmud that was composed in Israel was being taught, the Jews were constantly at the mercy of a constantly growing and influential Catholic Church and an insensitive Roman government. I just like to quote just one passage from the Gemara in Shabbos, 145b, to give you a sense of the events. Omer Rabbi Yitzchak. Rabbi Yitzchak said, "There's ein lecho kol regel v'regel. There's no single festival. In other words, Pesach, Shavuos, Sukkot, when troops did not come to Sepphoris, to Tzipori." In other words, the Roman legions would make it a point that whenever there'd be a Jewish holiday, they would go in mass, go into the city. You know, and expect the Jews to feed them and take care of them. And there's every single holiday, like Lahachas, and they just made it a point to disturb every holiday. Tzipor was a major Jewish city. It says, in every festival, it says, in Tveria, which was then, again, the other major Jewish population center, a general, says, one of the generals with his troops, with his staff and centurions, would come in also. Just they happened to schedule themselves just on Yom Tov to harass the Jews. This, of course, is just these are just a few examples, and their suffering, just a sense of what happened throughout the whole period, will be detailed in this lecture as well as subsequent lectures. But however, throughout this whole period of suffering, the study of Torah flourished. One major contributing factor was a constant flow of scholars and potential scholars that traveled from the yeshivas of Babylon to study at the feet of the masters of Torah in Israel. These scholars, in turn, eventually assumed major positions of leadership in Israel. Their story, the stories of their colleagues in Israel, and the creation of the Talmud Yerushalmi, the Talmud that these scholars created, is the subject of tonight's lecture. As I stated before, Babylon was a major source of students and scholars for the yeshivas of Israel. You have in your notes, the first page, we quote a Gemara in Sukkah, that Reish Lakish, who was a native of Israel, pointed out, he says, that through various critical points of Jewish history, scholars came from Babylon, as Babylon was equally a center of Torah, just as Israel was. And from the earliest times, yeshivas and the study of Torah flourished. It would be probably akin to the situation today. We have yeshivas in America, we have yeshivas in Israel. During the time when Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi wrote his Mishnah, let's put it, or compiled the Mishnah, he was helped by Babylonian scholars who happened to come up at the time, Rabbi Chiya and his sons. Before that, Hillel, at a time when there was really a vacuum of leadership and scholarship, Hillel came up from Babylon and assumed the mantle of leadership. In the beginning of the Second Commonwealth, again, after the community had been established, Ezra came up, really the greatest luminary of that generation from Babylon, those who would to lead them. Babylon has always been a constant source of renewal, and it was very important for these. You have to realize they were decimated in numbers. This is after the Bar Kokhba rebellion. They moved to the Galilee, which really was not really a Mokum Torah. This didn't have great generations of scholars and scholarship. And there was really a lack. And here you had all these students, these greats who had studied in the Babylonian academies, that came to finish their studies in Israel. And as we're going to see, they became the greatest leaders in many critical periods. And it was difficult for them. For many reasons for them to make the trip, the Babylonians, to make that trip. Today, for American yeshiva bocher to go to Israel, okay, it's a minimal cost, less than a day's travel, and he's there. Travel was very arduous, very long, very often not safe. And to compound matters, the approach that they had studied in Babylon was different. The analysis, the approach to the text, was different in the Babylonian yeshivas as it was in the Israeli yeshivas, in the yeshivas in Eretz Yisrael. To the extent, if you're looking at the second paragraph, on the first page, Rabbi Zera fasted 100 fasts that he should forget the Talmud Bavli. Now, there's not the facts, but the approach. Because he didn't want to start thinking like an Israeli. I just met with somebody last night who was overjoyed, says they just received an Israeli driver's license. Now they'll be able to really drive like an Israeli. I'm going to keep my distance from him. Well, Zera wanted to think like an Israeli, at least at that time. And he was afraid that, you know, the way he approached it would be so different, he just would never get it. And he fasted 100 fasts. So that was one impediment. Another impediment was the fact that the Rosh Yeshivas in Israel, in Babylon, were not overjoyed to lose their students. And there had been not only is just there's a natural tendency. I remember when I left from my yeshiva to Lakewood, it was not, it isn't easy to leave. And I know my children who left their yeshivas to go on to other yeshivas had difficulties. But to compound this, there was a feeling from the Rabbi Yehuda, and probably it echoed in others of the generation, maintained the Jews in Babylon were meant to stay in Babylon until Moshiach came. This is their place. And he really felt that they were violating Torah law. It isn't just the fact that you're leaving my yeshiva. Because probably, and I mean, it's not recorded, but one would understand it. But there was a really a matter of principle as well. Of course, these students, Menachem, did not abide by his ruling and maintained, the opinion of those who disagreed with him. But it was a pressure. And as it is today, a pressure very often leaving one yeshiva to go to another. But this, the difficulty, the trip, the pressure from the leadership of Babylon to stay, the difference in methodology was countered by what was to be gained by going to Israel. And turn to page 2. Abaye said, and this is that one of them, there was something to be said. It says that one who studies in Israel, there's a special siyata d'shmaya. There's a special help from heaven. Then we find on paragraph F. As the Rebbe Zera said, it says, the very air of Israel makes one wise. And in all probability, it stems from a fact, which is really, it goes really beyond this lecture. Every day, we make the bracha, we say the benediction about the giving of the Torah. Thank Hashem for giving us the mitzvah to involve ourselves in the learning of Torah. We thank Hashem for choosing the Jewish people. And we end that bracha. This is Baruch Atah Hashem Nosein HaTorah, the giver of Torah. And the commentaries explain the giving of Torah is not an event that occurred once in history. It's a constant. God is always giving the Torah. The ability to understand is a God-given gift, and one has to merit that gift. Just as we say that in a synagogue, or in a yeshiva, in a base medrash, where Jews come together to pray or to study, the Shechina is there, the divine presence is there. In the same sense, a divine presence is in the land of Israel. And therefore, one who studies in Israel gets greater help. Rabbi Zera was afraid, and this is why he fasted 100 fasts, that he would be confused. In other words, the way he studied here in Babylon would be a detriment. But it seems from this, if you look on the first paragraph of page 2, that in truth really it was an enhancement. Even though, as Abaye said, says one of them, of the Israelis, is as good as two of the Babylonians, the Rava said, but when a Babylonian goes up to Israel, he's twice as good as an Israeli. Which makes him four times as good as a regular Babylonian, if you know your math, right? So there was something to be gained by going. And in fact, it seems that one built with one's background in Bovo, plus being in Israel, one really shined. Just to give you a sense, this is the end, this is the last paragraph of this section, of the feelings of those who made that trip. And it wasn't, again, an easy trip. Let's just read together the beginning here. Let's take from a Gemara in Ksubas in Kuf Yud Beis 112. It says it starts. I usually put A or B. This starts on A and goes on to B. Rabbi Zera went up. When Rabbi Zera went up to the land of Israel, he couldn't find a ferry as he was going across a river. And he had to cross a river. He grasped a rope bridge. In other words, a rope bridge was a contract, as I understand it, that they had. They ran across the river. Really, was a little plank. On both sides of this plank were two poles that again held another rope, and you had to walk. Unless you had to walk hand over hand. And that's how Reb Zera crossed the river. You know, I hope he didn't have too much baggage, you know. He had to go across the river to get to Israel. A certain Sadducee, this is translated, this is probably from the censors, this probably means a mean, heretic, Gnostic or a Christian, sneered at him. He says, you know, you Jewish people, you know, you're so hasty, you do things without thinking. He says, you know, when God told you to receive, you know, he asked you if you want to receive the Torah, the Jews said, Nasa v'nishma, we'll do and then we'll hear. And the Jews were willing to do before they heard. You're such an impetuous people. You should have listened then what God had in store for you before you, where you said yes or no. It's still with you. Reb Zera answered, he says, you know what, he says Moses, Moshe Rabbeinu, Aaron never made it. He says, I have the opportunity of entering the land of Israel. I don't care how difficult it is. I'm going there. And this is Rabbi Abba, again, a Babylonian who came to study, one of the great scholars, to kiss the cliffs. In other words, by Akko, says the stones of Akko, says he kissed them. Rabbi Hanina came, Rabbi Hanina, it seems as our Rav Isaac Leib, this is the famous Rabbi Hanina, who was a disciple of Rabbi Huda Chosid. He came, he repaired the roads. In other words, he wanted to do something for Israel. Rav Chiya Bar Gamdas was rolled in the dust. There was such a love for Israel because it represented them not just the national homeland, not the place where all Jews belong, but it's the place where the Shechina is. It's where the divine presence is. They came back to Hashem, in a sense. So let's just quickly go over this section. The positive is that Israel had a renewing source, and that was the Jews from Babylon. It wasn't easy for them to go. It was a difficult journey. As you see there, even the bridges were out. They had to go over these makeshift bridges. There was a problem of methodology. There was a problem. The leadership of the Babylonian academies were not always for that. Their bachurim should leave. But yet, the draw, the benefits was such that they felt drawn to it. One of the major benefits, of course, were not only the fact is about the heir of Israel, but the great people who were teaching Torah in Israel. The first subject, the first person I'd like to discuss, and what I want to give you, hopefully, says when we finish this lecture, is really two points. One, I'd like to give you a sense of the chronology. We're going to go through the chronology and the historical events that occurred during this period. But second, and perhaps even more important, to give you a sense of who these people are. And if one reads a quote, hears a name, one studies the Talmud, in the Talmud both the Palestinian and the Babylonian scholars were studied and mentioned at length. They're just names. You know? They're not real people. And the essence of the Torah is not just is really Masorah, you know, the Torah is passed on, you know, from Rebbe to Talmud, back and back. These are real people. You know, just as we're studying Torah now, it says, I was privileged to learn in Baltimore of Ruderman and of Kotler and Lakewood, who they in turn learned from great people who in turn learned. That goes back all the way to these people here. I mean, these are real people. So I'd give you a sense of who they were, what challenge, what unique challenges they had in life, what unique facets of their character are something that we can be inspired by and perhaps gain. So those are the two that are just to focus on. Rabbi Elazar, who of the Babylonians, who are mentioned in the Talmud, in the Talmud Yerushalmi, is probably the most prestigious and the oldest. Was a very close disciple of the leading scholars in Babylon in the first generation of the Talmud. And this is on page 3, we just have briefly of quotes, and there are many more, I just took the samplings, of how he had studied by Shmuel, how he studied by Rav. These are the subject of previous lectures. He left them to study by Rabbi Chanina. Rabbi Chanina was one of the leading, what seems, Babylonian scholars who left Babylon to study with Rabbi Yehuda Hanossi, Rabbi Yehuda the Prince, the editor of the Mishnah. When Rabbi Yehuda Hanossi died in his last, in his will before he died, he mentioned that Rabbi Chanina should take the position of Rosh Yeshiva, the head of the yeshiva, after his death. So he was a person of tremendous stature. Rav, another great disciple of Rabbi Yehuda Hanossi, was not mentioned. So evidently Rabbi Chanina was a scholar of the first class. Not only, of course, as he mentioned throughout the Talmud, but it would be understood that one who had drank the waters of Rav and Shmuel would like to make the trip to study under, let's say, their colleagues. Someone in a certain sense superior to them. And Rabbi Elazar left Rav and Shmuel, even though it seems that intermittently he came back to Babylon to study by Rabbi Chanina. And it is Rabbi Elazar who was really this following statement. Even someone who has never opened the pages of the Talmud is familiar with the statement in paragraph C. Omer Rabbi Elazar, Omer Rabbi Chanina, this is said in davening. For those who say davenus of Svart, it's every day. Otherwise, it's said on Shabbos. Rabbi Elazar and Rabbi Chanina, Talmidei Chachamim Marvim Shalom Ba'olam. Disciples of the wise increase peace in the world. Shenemar v'chol banayach l'mudei Hashem v'rav shloim banoyach. Al tikra banoyach ala boinoyach. As the children shall be taught of Hashem, of the Lord, and great shall be the peace of thy children. It's pronounced your children. But because of the repetition of the word your children, there's a second meaning. This is Al Tikre. This is the second meaning, but Boinech, the builders, scholars are called builders. They build peace in the world. And it was so important. There are 4 tractates of the Talmud that end with this statement. Those 4 tractates are Brachos, Nozer, Yevamos, and Krisus. The first letters of these 4 mesechtas spell out the word Bonoyach. Beis of Brachos, Nun of Nozer, Yod of Yevamos, and Kof of Krisus. So it has this. To dwell on this for just a moment, the fact is it's included in davening. The fact is the 4 tractates end on this note. What seems to me this is a very important idea. And yet, the whole idea is only hinted at. It's not even written expressly. It's hinted at by saying the word bonayach twice, your sons twice, is a hint that there's another. It has another meaning. It's only alluded to that scholars produce peace. And what wonders, if it's so important, say it outright. And it's only hinted at, you know, in a verse, in, you know, in Yeshayahu, in Isaiah. So I heard from someone, there was a mashulach, someone was collecting. He told me this one, it's a beautiful idea. And he started off with a question that many have asked. You know, it's a little strange. He says, you know, the scholars, Talmid Chachamim, produce peace. If you've ever, you look with open eyes in the world, it seems some of the greatest machloikas, some of the greatest controversies are between scholars. You know, you have Hasidim and Misnagdim, you know, that the controversy is somewhat cooled now after so many hundreds of years. Historically, it was a very passionate art, you know, it was a very passionate, between sides of great scholars. The argument between this is Rabbi Yonis and Ibshitz, and this is Rabbi Yaakov Emden, two great scholars in the middle of the 18th century. Terrible. I mean, it's throughout. And it's just a little strange. What do you mean they increase peace? One great rabbi said, with tongue in cheek, he offered the following explanation. The word olam, it says, you know, in the world, the word olam, in a colloquial sense, you know, it means the small world. It means the community. You know, what's doing in the olam? You know, the in any congregation, in any community, there are different groups, right? There are different factions, and left to their own devices, they themselves will be, you know, will produce. That's why there's so many different shuls. You know, why do we have so many different shuls? In halacha, you know, this is the ideal of Jewish law, is that you should have one, in a community, you have one large congregation. This is Beroiv Am Hadras Melech. With the immensity of the congregation, you know, so too, that's the honor given to the king. The larger the congregation, the better. But it's also brought there's a qualifying statement in Jewish law that if there's controversy within the congregation, it's best that they split. And that's why we have so many shuls. In one congregation, though, in one community, while there's still one, you know, they're still together, under the surface, very often, he's not happy with this one and he's not happy with that one. But when they're not happy with the rabbi, it brings them all together. It says, Talmidei Chachamim marvim shalom b'olam. Scholars produce peace in the olam, you know, in the community, because now there's a central figure they can all attack. Right? This is a rabbi said this tongue in cheek. That, of course, that's not the pshat, but it's a nice vehicle anyway. But I think equally good is, which is probably the real pshat. I remember I said, well, I once went to an advertising agency, and he had on the sign, he says answers, with a big sign, answers. So it was $1.50. Answers with some thought, $2.50. The right answer, $3.50. You know? There's a lot of answers to questions, you know? Says, I think this one is the right answer, the following that I heard. He says, you know, it's true. There's a lot of controversy among scholars. But the peace that they create is something which is very subtle. The fact is, the person who learns Torah on a spiritual level creates a whole different world. It's not something you can see. What you see contradicts what's occurring. But the fact is that people have a greater sense of spirituality is to a large degree because there are people devoted to spirituality. It vibrates. It's like this, we've told this in this class before. Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, the founder of the Musar movement, told his students, he says, you know, be very careful in your study of Torah. Because when you're negligent in your studies here, it creates a ripple effect that there may be a Jew in Paris who has been toying with the idea, should he assimilate, should he not assimilate, should he convert to Catholicism or become a Protestant, or should he remain as a Jew? His ties to Judaism are very tenuous. To the extent that you learn Torah here, it creates a ripple effect. His soul feels his Jewishness all the more. And when you're negligent in your studies, there's a coldness in your heart, so to speak. That coldness, you know, vibrates there. He has that. He also doesn't feel, on his level, his Jewishness. So he says, be very careful so what you do affects not only yourself, it affects the world. In that sense, scholars who study Torah just add peace to the world. But it's very subtle. And that's why the whole idea is only alluded to and not expressly stated. It's with an altikrin. You have to take a double takeover here. It says, hey, that's funny. Why is this benoich extra here? It's something which is hinted at and alluded to, but not expressly stated, because that's the way it works. It's not on a level that you can see, but it's still there beneath the surface. I think it's a very, very nice pshat. I heard from the name of another rabbi. He was again probably involved in part of the great rabbinical controversies. Saying about this, the Talmid Chachamim, you know, increased peace in the world. He says, you know, those rabbis had a great sense of humor. But I think the pshat with the that I heard with the subtlety is the true pshat. Yeah. Rebbe Lozer, who said, left Rav and Shmuel. He eventually became, after Rebbe Chanina passed away, he became Rebbe Yochanan's disciple. And as it says, just a sense of what it was, is on the end of page 3, says that when he used to leave Rabbi Yochanan, he used to step backwards all the way until he could no longer see Rabbi Yochanan. That was the sense of respect and homage that he paid towards Rabbi Yochanan. But if there's one thing that stands out, and you can look at the other factors which I've quoted here, but if there's one thing that stands out in his personality, and I think that's something that is very important for all of us, was his relationship with his own poverty. Everyone has unique challenges in life. But one thing which just seems to be very unique in the life of Rebbe Lozer is the difficulties that he had of making a living. If you just to quote just one quote now, it says on paragraph G. Rebbe Lozer is on page 4 in paragraph G. Rebbe Lozer fell ill. Rebbe Yochanan went to visit him. When Rebbe Yochanan came in, he noticed he was sitting lying down in a dark room. And in the dark, he couldn't afford a lamp. Rabbi Yochanan bared his arm and light radiated from him. This is a theme we had in the theme. Rabbi Yochanan, it literally, at least we take this, that it shined. And when he saw his complexion, Rabbi Yochanan's beautiful complexion, it shined, Rabbi Lozer started weeping. He started crying. And Rabbi Yochanan said, what are you crying for? Evidently he was afraid, you know, that he was going to die and, you know, leave this world. And he says, is it a problem you're crying because you feel, says, you may die, you'll be taken, you know, to account, you didn't study enough Torah. So he says, you know, he says, in God's eyes, it's not the amount of what you've done. It's the effort, and says, Echad Amar v'Echad Hamamet, says, the one who does more, the one who does less. The important thing is if your motivation was pure, and you tried your best, and that's all that matters in God's eyes. It isn't we honor Torah, we look at the scholar. But if a person who, because of various reasons, couldn't be a scholar, but with what he has and the time that's given to him, he tries his best, and his motivation is pure, that's really all that counts. We can't, very often, we can't decide in life the situations that are, you know, the cards that are dealt us. But we have to make the best of it, and that's all Hashem expects of us. So Rabbi Yochanan was trying to console. Rabbi Elazar says, don't feel that you didn't become the scholar you wanted to. As long as you've tried, says, that's the important thing. He says, are you crying? Because maybe it's not the fear of death, it's just how life is so difficult. He says, you don't have what to eat. You don't have sustenance. He says, you know, not everybody, loy kol adam zeich l'shtei shulchanos. Not everyone has the privilege of enjoying two tables. There's the table of the world to come and this world. He says, be happy, he says, that at least is you have the opportunity to acquire the next world. And this is a thing we're going to discuss in a moment. Is it because you don't have children? He had lost children. Rabbi Yochanan took it. Rabbi Yochanan himself had lost 10 children. And he took off the bone. There's a question what this bone is. It was from the meal that was given when they, you know, by the Sudas Havro, you know, by the mourner's meal. He took off something just to show them for the mourner's meal. There was a tooth of one of the children that had fallen off, you know, like a baby tooth, one of the kids that had died. Whatever it is, I've also suffered. But evidently, Rabbi Elazar was a person who suffered. And it's interesting that both together, and in the lecture about Rabbi Yochanan, we also discussed the sacrifice, at least early on in his life, Rabbi Yochanan had to make. And they both knew what it meant to be poor. And it's just very significant that they were our teachers in paragraph H. Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Elazar said jointly, because when a person needs support of his fellow creatures, you need a loan, you need a handout, you feel so ill at ease to ask, his face changes colors like the krum. Krum is translated to be the bird of paradise. And there's like his face changes all kinds of colors because of embarrassment and shame. They taught us this not only because it's true, but it's very well because it's part of their own experience. But I think probably the most noteworthy thing about Rabbi Elazar was not only the difficulties he personally had to go through, but what he did with those difficulties. Because if you look in the Talmud, Rabbi Elazar is virtually throughout the whole Talmud. He is a major teacher. But there are certain sugyas in the Talmud. There are certain sections that there are like basically a few teachers. And about this, there's a statement from these rabbis, a statement from those rabbis. When it comes to the parsha of tzedakah, of giving charity, Rabbi Elazar is a major teacher. Of course, it was included in the Talmud, felt that this was part of the Torah itself. It wasn't Rabbi Elazar's experience somehow changed anything. This is part of the Torah. And he's teaching us as part of the Mesorah of the Torah, part of the transmission of the Torah. But yet he was the one who had the merit of being quoted. It's not in the notes. So let me just quote you some of the quotes, and it's fascinating. Rabbi Elazar said, let's take from a Gemara in Sukkah. I'll just summarize this. Mem Tesom and Beis in 49b. Greater is a person, this is, again, he was our Rebbe in terms of tzedakah, of giving charity. Greater is the performance of charity than those who give sacrifices in the temple. God loy said tzedakah yosu mikola karbonis. It's greater than the sacrifices. Gemilas chasodim, doing kindness, is greater than charity. And there's physically visiting the sick, cheering up someone, is greater than just taking out money. He says, and he said, the reward of charity depends entirely upon the extent of the kindness. You know, it isn't enough just to give the money. It's how you give the money. There are people who don't just need the money. They need the psychological boost from another person who can sympathize and give them the strength to go on in life. And it was he who taught, you know, the importance of not, it just, very often people have the tendency, the sense of, listen, I'm going to pool my money, I'll give it one gift to Federation, I don't have to look at these poor people. And let them take care of it. The fact is, unfortunate people come to your door to meet you in shul or whatever, and pour out their heart. It isn't just the money. These are people who need more than money. And that's all part of the process. And there's a very cute story from Rav Levi Yitzchak Bardichever, one of the great Hasidic teachers. In the town of Bardichev, they just didn't like the fact that beggars went from door to door, and they wanted to create like a communal thing, that there were no beggars, they would just go to one central organization and get a gift. And he was the rabbi of the congregation, and he sat together with the board, the equivalent, of what would be in the modern day the board of directors of the synagogue or the community. And he originally, his original contract with the community, basically he was there like to negotiate new business, new problems. But that which had been settled already, old business, that wasn't his. Other rabbis had already instituted those things. He was the new problems. So when they brought this on the table, he got up and he started leaving. He says, "What are you leaving for?" He says, "It's an important issue." He says, "I was only hired to take care of new business, not old business." He says, "What do you mean it's old? It's new business." "No. It's been taken by the people of Sodom and Gomorrah before. They also didn't want the beggars to come. That's old business." So part of it isn't just the money. It's people want the handshake. They want the warmth. They want their brachas. Tzedakah is not just the money. Rebbe Elazar is our Rebbe. And he said also, we spoke about the ripple effect before, about learning Torah, how it has effect. Rebbe Elazar is the ripple effect about giving charity. He says, "He who executes charity and justice is regarded as though he had filled the whole world with kindness." When you lift up the level in your own, amongst the people you meet, it has an effect, a subtle effect, across the whole world. The world becomes a better place. Very often there are concerns we have. We have concerns about our own home, about our community, and there are concerns about the world. But we can satisfy, at least partially, our concerns by the world by satisfying the concerns at home. If we're better people, the world becomes a better place. It's this ripple effect. We're all this, our spiritual, we have one great soul. To the extent that we lift ourselves up, we lift up the whole world. Rebbe Elazar taught us this. Rebbe Elazar, this is all taken from the Gemara in Sukkah, and this is the Mem Tesom and Beis in 49b. In Bava Basra and Tesom and Aleph in 9a also, he taught us a whole, again, another aspect of tzedakah. Very often, there's a problem, there are needs to give charity. And we want the community involved. And there has to be one person who's going to bring all the force of the community, inspire them to knock on the doors, to get people involved in this project. He says, Godel ha-ma'asa min osa. The person who gets others involved is doing a greater mitzvah than the givers themselves. It's a tougher job. It's a tough job being a collector. One great rabbi explained this. In every juncture of life, there's a yetzer hara. There's evil inclination. There's this something in the way that the mitzvah shouldn't be done. He said, why should the sotan, why should the yetzer hara, why should the evil inclination put all his efforts onto all these individuals that this money collector will try to get from? He'll just do it on the money collector. He'll put all his efforts to dissuade the money. Don't do it. Look at the embarrassment you have, and it's so hard, and it's so. He says, don't do it. What do you need this for? And he makes it, the difficulties are put in his path. Because if they get rid of him, then they get rid of the whole project. if you have someone who's inspired, who's knocking on doors and telling people to give, so the evil inclination has to work on every individual donor to stop him from giving. Whereas if he stops the facilitator, he stops it in his track. Says it won't happen. Says that's why says it's so hard being a money collector. But the mitzvah, again, we're assuming you're collecting, you know, for a worthy cause. You know, it's not for your own. It's you're collecting for some other cause, and you're trying to get these people involved. Says the mitzvah is so much greater. So go to Hamasim and Osa. He is our teacher. Yeah. He says the importance of tzedakah. He says just like he compares. He brings a verse. Says that tzedakah is like mail armor. In other words, you know, a coat of mail, you know, of chains. Says it's all made up. You know, the ancient armor was made of these little chains, all linked together, which made it that the soldier wore that it would be very difficult for a sword or an arrow to penetrate. But it's all made up just little on themselves, just little rings. But together they form this whole. He says tzedakah is the same thing. Every little penny adds up. You know, you give a little here, a little there, but it all adds up to create this whole coat of armor. Don't feel bad that you can't give so much now. Just keep on giving. A little today, a little tomorrow, it adds up. Rebbe Lozer is our teacher. And I was thinking, and I think it's an important lesson, again, it goes beyond this particular lecture. Each one of us has unique challenges in life. Rebbe Lozer's challenge was poverty. And in fact, just to get a sense of what that challenge was, there's a Gemara in Tainus, in Chof Hei Omed Aleph, in 25a, that describes that because of his poverty, he was for a medicinal, which was a common medicinal practice. They used to do cupping, you know, bankas, and they used to bleed people. And a person would be weakened. And he didn't have food to take after he went through this procedure. In fact, he took a skin of garlic, that's all he had, and it caused a reaction, and he collapsed. And really became like comatose. And he had, at least the Talmud describes, a vision in this comatose state. And the vision was that he saw God himself. And he asked Hashem, says, how long will I have to suffer like this? So maybe I could change things. So Hashem replied to Rebbe Lozer, says, do you want me to change the world back to its very beginnings? In other words, you were created to be poor. For me to change it, I have to recreate the world, and I don't know how you'd land up then. Rebbe Lozer asks, have I lived most of my life yet? In other words, how much more will I have? He says, you've lived most of your life already. He says, okay, I'll continue in taking this challenge. And the Talmud goes on to explain his reward because of that he accepted this suffering. The Vilna Gaon explains the idea of mazel. Why is it that some people, their lot is just suffering, and other people, their lot is wealth or this or that? He says, to a great degree, it's dependent on how a person lived in a previous lifetime. The idea of living, coming in this world again, is very much rooted in the Kabbalistic tradition. It's discussed at very great length in the Zohar. The people have come before, haven't finished their task in life, and they very often have to come back again. Rebbe Lozer's mazel was to be poor. What he did with the feeling of poverty and that experience of poverty was he took his own poverty and enriched us with it. Because not only was he a person who accepted this poverty, who learned to live with this poverty, to the extent, as you've learned on page 4 in paragraph F, he didn't even accept gifts from the Nasi, from the prince, to alleviate that poverty. But he saw it as a challenge, there is a challenge from him how to accept it. But he used that feeling to know what it feels to be poor. And evidently it was, I can only theorize, the reason he was destined to be poor was that in another lifetime he was given wealth and he did not utilize it in the proper way. So he took his new experience as part of the tikkun, part of fixing what he'd come down to earth. He not only accepted his own poverty, but taught others the importance of giving tzedakah. That he became one of our major teachers for all generations of what it means and the importance of giving charity. So he took his challenge and he turned it over, and not only did he lift himself up, but he lifted up the whole world. Each of us have unique challenges and everyone is different. We have to ask ourselves, not only how do I live through this challenge, how do I not be spoiled by it and put down by it, but how do I take my own experience and perhaps touch the lives of others? You know, just very interesting, and then we'll go on to another point. In Alcoholics Anonymous, there's a 12-step program. One of those steps is bringing other alcoholics in and teaching them through their own experience and trying to help others. Very often we're given challenges in life and we know how difficult it is, but now because of that we can help others. And I think it's when you look at it yourself, you'll see, says, I think this is the way we can best understand Rebbe Lazar. So not only is he our great teacher of all the great wisdom passed in the Talmud, but he's a great teacher of, you know, how to live life itself. If we go just back in the last page, we have a chronology, we have a timeline. If you'll notice in the timeline, some of this has been covered already. As we say, Rebbe Lazar himself went up, left Rav and Shmuel, and went to study in the yeshivas. It had to be somewhere, in all probability. We find Rebbe Lazar by Rabbi Chanina. It would have to be sometime after the year 220 when Rav arrives in Babylon. In all probability, because of the ages, I mean, it was probably closer to the year 230, the death of Rabbi Yehuda Anasi the first, Rabbi Yehuda Anasi in the sea of the first, Rabbi Yehuda Anasi the second. So here he comes in approximately year 230 to year 232. Rabbi Yochanan founds the Yeshiva of Tiberias. Let's just go over the dating. The year 245, Rabbi Oshia, as we're going to see, one of the great teachers in the previous lecture, he's going to come up soon, passed away. The year 247, Rav passed away. The year 253, Shmuel. After this time, Rebbe Lazar was totally, even though we find him back and forth, he's totally now in Israel. He's there with Rabbi Yochanan for well over 30 years. And in fact, Rabbi Yochanan was Nifter, he took the mantle of leadership, this Rebbe Lazar, but it was only for a year. After his death, Rabbi Ami became the leader. It was in the year 288. If you turn to page 5, Rabbi Ami, who had studied evidently he had studied also by Rav and Shmuel. When they came, it seems he came when Rabbi Oshia was still alive. And we said the death of Rabbi Oshia approximately in the year 245. He was a student of Rabbi Oshia's. We have in paragraph C in page 5, Rabbi Ami said, this is in bold type, I sat before Rabbi Oshia and studied, this is from him, for a long period of time, referring to a specific statement. I never heard that statement from him, and he questioned the validity of that statement. Evidently, when he came to Israel, he left Rav and Shmuel. he was not, it would seem from, and again from a quote from the first paragraph, they weren't at that time the greatest of the students of Rav and Shmuel. But they eventually grew to be the, to a position where these Babylonian scholars became, so in the year 288, became the leaders. Of the two, Rabbi Ami took Rabbi Elazar's place. And throughout the Talmud, both the Talmud Bavli and Yerushalmi, you find those both together. I just to briefly, just to because of the time, I'm not going to go into the personality of Rabbi Ami, but I just want to give you a sense again of the history. You know, most history that we have, if you look at any book of history and it looks, you see it flows, this happened, that happened, the other thing happened. Most history that's written by historians are actually works of research. They weren't there. They're not eyewitness reports. They take a little from here and they take a little from there and put it together. Assume a framework which is really not necessarily in the material itself and work through this framework. To a large extent, the history that we have of the Talmud is from what we're studying here, are from these individual selections. And from this section, this and this quote here, a picture emerges. If we want to get a sense of what was life like in Palestine, it's in page 6. And that deals with Rabbi Ami and Rabbi Yossi. Again, these two scholars who originally came from Babylon. They were sent by the this is Rabbi, which was this refers not to Rabbi Yehuda Hanossi, the editor of the Mishnah, but his great-great-grandson. And he sent them and said, I want you to improve the spiritual situation, the cities in the land of Israel. They went out, they went to a particular city, and they asked them, says, show me your watchman. Who guards your city? On page 6. They brought in the head of the guards and the sentry. You know, these are our watchmen. He says, they're not the watchmen. He says, they're the destroyers of your city. He says, what do you mean? He says, who are the watchmen then? He says, they're the teachers of scripture, of Mishnah. He says, if Jews are worthy of it, he says, Hashem will give them protection. And through this, you know, basically, they could have simply said, says, we're your teachers. But he wanted to impress upon them that when you study Torah, it's not just a matter of teaching. It's just not a matter of education. It's the matter of even the physical survival of the Jewish people. And that's something that these people were almost ignorant could understand. But it also gives you a sense that they had to look around because there was a lack. These people were, well, I said, this is by and large in the Galilee. These were not areas that had a history of scholarship. And they had to go around. But this is how they convinced them, which is just interesting just to know when you have to convince people. Now, I just saw, I don't want to share with you, I just saw this before Shabbos, the beautiful one. This was a collection of sayings from Reb Chaim Volozhiner. Chaim Volozhiner was the great disciple of the Vilna Gaon. I just opened it up. I was rearranging my Sforum. And I happen to look at it, you know, hey, what does this say? You know, I mean, you look at these, you know, you get these phone, you never look at them, so you feel guilty. So at least when you're putting away, you open them once to see, I got something from this one. So I open it up. It's a little short thing. He says, how do you, when people are arguing, you want to make peace between them. He says, what do you do? How do you make peace between these people? So he said, the important thing is you go to each one of the litigants. Is it tell them make pieces? You say, you know what? You're probably right. Good chance you're right. But you know, for the principle of peace, you go the extra mile and you give in something. Peace is more important than being right. You know, like he was right, dead right. You know, in the right of the way. You know, sometimes for the sake of peace, you give up. You're right, but it's still worthy to give up. And you go to the other party as well. You tell them. It's not an admission. This is by giving up. It's not an admission. This is that you're wrong. This is, you know, this compromising. But it's a strength that comes because peace comes. It's more important to promote peace in the community, says, than it is just to be right. says, that's the way you do it. He says, if you take the other way, and you go to the person is and say, you know what, you're probably wrong. You know, why don't you, is, you know, you're in the wrong. But like, if you compromise, you save face, and you'll, you know, you get out of the situation. No one will ever accept that. No one will ever want to hear that they're wrong. Everyone wants to hear that they're right. But if you tell them, yeah, you're right, but still you should do it for this and this and this, you have a greater chance in telling the person you're wrong. You have to know how to attack the situation. It's interesting, Rabbi Yarmouth of Asse says their approach was not, you know, you need the education. So the kids, what do I need education for? So they dramatized this. They came over and it says, where are your watchmen? They bring over the police force. So then he has to discredit them and make this whole show to bring, to make the point. Because, you know, very often you can't tell the truth. The truth is a, you know, they asked the Dubner Magid, there's a great, the Dubner Magid was famous, he lived some 200 years ago, that he would always clothe his statements, says, with a mushel, with some sort of analogy. He says, what do you always say a mushel for? What do you always say with a story? Why don't you say it straight out? He says, let me tell you with a mushel. Let me tell you with another analogy. He says, you know what? Truth. He says, the naked came stark naked knocking at people's doors. No one wanted to let him in. So he happened to bump into Moshel. This is an analogy, you know, the story. He says, you know, and Moshel says, what are you so down and out? He says, no one wants to let me in. He says, let me tell you. He says, I'll give you the clothes. I'll give you my stories. You'll look like a well-dressed, they'll let you in. He says, and that's what happened. He says, truth doesn't come in by itself. You have to clothe it. And it reminds me, says the one of the great Magidim of Yerushalayim, Sholem Shvadron. He was a subject of the, there was a book, The Magid Speaks. I didn't hear him say this, but someone who was there told me that he was speaking. Why is it that these Magidim, these preachers, always said it with stories and with laughter and jokes? Whereas there are other rabbis, you know, who just tell it as it is. You know, just say it. He says, what do you have to always, you know, skirt the issue and tell it with a mice and a joke and this? So he says, let me tell you a story. Let me tell you a mushel. Let me tell you a mice. He says, there were two kids that were very sick. He says, one was an older child, one was a younger child. The older child, you know, and this was in Europe many years ago, where they didn't, where the medicine was not in sugar, you know, it was not in candied syrup, you know, it wasn't in a pill that, you know, that you could just swallow. Think of it in bitter, you know, it was bitter, it was terrible. Says once with the older child, you could reason, I know you're sick, and it smells awful and it tastes awful, the medicine, but it's a lot better to undergo the nuisance of having this terrible medicine than being sick. And you could reason with the child, and she, okay, says, I'll take the medicine. You go to an infant, a little kid, a four-year-old kid, you tell him to take the medicine, he clamps down his mouth. You try to give the spoon, he clamps down his mouth. You try to push the spoon, he closes it, get the same. You know, you try to move it here, moves his face like this. You can't, you try to go around this way and that way, you can't get it in. So what do you do? He says, you start tickling the kid. He starts tickling, he starts laughing. You shove it in. He says, it's the same thing. He says, what do I, full of laughter? He says, like this, they're not going to hear it. It's like the bitter medicine. Hey, you give him a joke. You shove it in. So he says, the same thing as you see that, you know, it's just very interesting. Again, I'm just reading in between the lines. It's very interesting. It's not only what they said, but how they said it. You know, and again, it's a lesson. Again, we're going through the history of the times, but through the history we see the people. During Rabbi Ami, and again, you can look at the notes on your own. I just want to go through this as the history now. During Rabbi Ami's time, there was a major change. That the yeshiva, as we said, if you look again on the timeline, that Rabbi Yochanan moved, and this is what we discussed in the previous lecture, from Sepphoris, from Tzipori, where the Nasi was, where the head of the Sanhedrin was, he moved to Tiberias, to Tveria, and founded his yeshiva. That became the center of Torah, and became the political center, but it really became two centers, was in Tzipori, was in Sepphoris. The conditions, because of the Roman government, were such that the Jews could no longer be in Tveria, in Tiberias, and they had to move. And they moved to Caesarea and Caesarea, which we're going to discuss as in the next lecture. There were major changes during this time, and during this whole time so the Torah was being studied in Israel. The Talmud Yerushalmi is the syllabus of study of the yeshivas in what basically was Rabbi Yochanan's yeshiva in Tiberias. They moved from Tiberias to Caesarea in Rabbi Ami's time. When Rabbi Ami died, because of conditions, he was the last true Rosh Yeshiva. There was no other Rosh Yeshiva in his stead. They were still learning Torah. They had great people, but it was more of a conglomerate of scholars than rather one single figure. Of those people, I just want to briefly go over this to give you a sense of the kinds of people they were, who were colleagues of Rabbi Ami and Rabbi Yossi's, but who never at this point did not take his place. One was Rabbi Chiya Bar Abba, again a Babylonian. When he left Babylon on page 8, he served Rabbi Hanina. In fact, there's a story which we had brought in a previous lecture. Rabbi Hanina was walking in the streets of Tzipori, of Sepphoris. Rabbi Chiya Bar Abba was a young man, was supporting him. And people were running. They asked, where are they running to? They're running to hear Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Hanina felt so good. Rabbi Yochanan's my Talmud. I taught him all of Agadata, all of the Midrashic section of thing, all of Scripture except Mishlei and Koheles. He says, I am very lucky to see my own lifetime the success of my students. But this is Rabbi Chiya Bar Abba who was accompanying him. Rabbi Chiya Bar Abba was accompanying Rabbi Shua ben Levi. These were the greats of the generations. He had the privilege. He left Israel. He left Babylon to study in Israel. One thing very unique with Rabbi Chiya Bar Abba, and again, just important. These people were brilliant people, but they were always reviewing. Rabbi Chiya Bar Abba reviewed all his studies every 30 days. That's what he was always reviewing, and that's why of the disciples of Rabbi Yochanan, he amongst all had the most accurate, he most accurately told over Rabbi Yochanan's sayings. Rabbi Zeira, one thing we had previously, in the beginning of the lecture, we went through that he had gone over this rope bridge. He is the one who fasted 100 fasts. He was a great tzaddik. He was extremely humble. In fact, so just in his humility, and he was, it seems, a person of modest stature. He was an extremely modest person and a very poor person. And he was given the opportunity of being appointed, given smicha, which means appointed to be an official judge, which is a thing of responsibility. But it was also, basically, it seems there was a certain status which is conferred on someone who has smicha, was given this ordination. It's really a position of a judgeship. He didn't want it. And he said, and this is on top of page 10, he says, a person should always remain obscure because you'll live longer. And Rabbi Elazar he didn't want it until he heard this statement of Rabbi Elazar, which we've quoted before, because, a person doesn't rise to greatness. God sees to it. It's like Yom Kippur. His sins are atoned before he's given this position. You're given a new lease on life. he was willing to go through it. But he was a person who just ran away from even though he was one of the greats of the generation. When he was ordained, the song that they sang was, he says, you know, like he is like a chal, like srak, says, like pirchus, neither paint nor rouge nor hair dye. He has none of the trappings. He wasn't a tall person. He wasn't a person that commanded respect, but he still radiated charm. Says Vialis Chayn. This was the kind of, again, you could look at the notes about the, you know, but these were the kinds of people, and again, they were all Babylonians, who were our leadership. You know, when you read the pages of the Gemara and you go through it and you hear a name here and you hear a name there, they're very, very special people. I mean, just besides their scholarship, they're truly great, great tzaddikim. You know, one of the major ideas we find is the idea of amunas chachamim, of trust, you know, in our sages. Amunas chachamim, as I understand, does not mean that you trust them that everything they say is right. Because if Rabbi Yechon says one way, Reish Lakish disagrees, or Rabbi Elazar disagrees. What you trust them is, whatever they say it as sages. It's with the greatest integrity, with the greatest effort. They went through all the methodology. They have no hidden agenda. They have no way. They're not hiding anything. They are telling it with the greatest sitkis, with the greatest sincerity. That's what Amunas Chachamim is. What you're trusting them is they are using their powers, of Torah, to help us, you know, to enlighten us. And that's the trust we have. And it's not necessarily that what they're saying has to be right, because one scholar says something and another scholar disagrees. But the faith is they are saying it as scholars, as sincere, righteous people who have gone through the proper methodology, have read through all the texts, and are saying it as part of their, just as one probably goes to a doctor for an opinion. They're world-renowned specialists. It doesn't mean that there are other specialists who may disagree with his approach. But the Amuna is, at least I'm saying it as a learned doctor. He just didn't decide flippantly he's going to say this or say that. He's doing it on the basis of all his cumulative years of experience. And because of his integrity as a master of his profession, that's the same idea of amunas chachamim. But it's important enough to have amunas chachamim to see what these chachamim were. I think it's part of the, I hope, to be gleaned from this. After this generation, after Rabbi Ami Rassi died, after Rabbi Chiya Bar Abba and Rabbi Zera, the next generation was led by Rabbi Yonah. These people already were, it seems, Israelis. The yeshivas in Babylon were such had reached that there were less people going over. And the leadership was composed of who were born in Israel. Rabbi Yonah and Rabbi Yirmiya, as is on top of page 11, both disciples, pupils of Rabbi Zera. Rabbi Yonah and Rabbi Zera, both pupils of Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Yonah still had studied by Rabbi Yochanan at the end of Rabbi Yochanan's life, very early in Rabbi Yonah's life, together with Rabbi Yirmiya, a disciple of Rabbi Zera, another Babylonian. Rabbi Yonah himself seems to be from Palestine. And he, with Rabbi Yirmiya, represented the next generation. Rabbi Yonah's son, Rabbi Mani, says, represented the last generation. And again, if he looks as in the timeline, and again, it's just fascinating. I want you, if you can look in the notes itself, the story that I have from the Gemara in Tainus about Rabbi Yonah. It says of Rabbi Mani. Rabbi Mani, the son, had many problems. And when he had problems, he went to the gravesite of his father, Rabbi Yonah, to pray. And this is one of the major sources that we, if a person goes to the Kever Avos, a person goes to the graves of his ancestors, to tzaddikim, to, you know, when they pray, to go at their gravesite, is based on this quote. It's one of there's three quotations. This is one of them. This is at the this is on page 12 here. Rabbi Mani was annoyed by the members of the household of the patriarch. He went and prostrated himself on the grave of his father. He said, "His father, father," says, "Abba, Abba, these people persecute me." And once, as they were passing the grave, the members of the house of the patriarch, again, he was no longer head of the Sanhedrin; he was just the political head. The knees of their horses became stiff and remained so. In other words, they happened to pass by the grave, and the horse got stuck, and they didn't move, says, until they promised not to hurt Rabbi Mani. But this is one of the sources about praying at the gravesite of a tzaddik. Again, the sense of the history, we've gone through several generations. These are all the authors of the Talmud. We have Rabbi Yochanan, says, and his disciples and those who came to study by his Rebbeim. As we have, says, Rabbi Lozer, Rabbi Ami, Rabbi Yasi, says, Rabbi Chiya Bar Abba, says, and later on, says, Rabbi Zera, who came. Rabbi Yirmiyah came after that. As we find Rabbi Yonah and Rabbi Mani, if you look at the timeline, is the end of the thing. The death of Rabbi Mani is approximately the year 350. In the year 352, Sepphoris itself was destroyed. That marked the end of the Talmud Yerushalmi. Rabbi Mani, says Rabbi Yossi Barbun, his colleague, were the last of the great scholars mentioned in the Talmud Yerushalmi. The Talmud Yerushalmi is the collective sayings and teachings from Rabbi Yochanan, began as yeshiva, as Rabbi Yochanan's teachings from the year 232 to the year 352. And of course, they brought the teachings of those who came before them, but this is the syllabus of that yeshiva, and it was really a continuity of that yeshiva. Even when they moved and they came back, the final place was in Tiberia. Rabbi Mani happened to move, says, at the end of his life to Sepphoris. But basically, this was the yeshiva, and these were some of the major scholars that, when you study Talmud Yerushalmi, it's their studies, their teachings that were studied. Emir Tashem, next week we'll go through the history of how we dealt with the growth of the Catholic Church in Israel and the persecution. And some of the major personalities who dealt with that struggle. Are there any questions? Okay. That's a very good point. The question is, why is the Talmud Yerushalmi so difficult? There are several reasons, and the question is, why isn't widely learned? And there are really two major reasons here. One is the Talmud Bavli, the Babylonian Talmud, was one which was edited. It's not just the syllabus of what was studied in the yeshivas. It was edited to be readable. The Talmud Yerushalmi would be the equivalent of personal notes. It was shorthand of what was studied in the yeshiva. So you have to decipher shorthand. The Talmud Bavli was written out long, so to make it readable. Because the Talmud Bavli was designed, Babylonian Talmud was designed, as we're going to go in subsequent lectures, to be the surviving document for Jews in the diaspora. It was written as such, and it was worked on as such. They didn't have the privilege in Israel to do that because of all the persecution. So all you have is just the notes. That's one reason. The second reason is that eventually the great scholars of Israel came to Babylon, participated in the creation of the Babylonian Talmud, and therefore the Babylonian Talmud is the last word. It is the most, in other words, it was produced later. They were cognizant of the teachings of the Talmud Yerushalmi, of the Israeli Talmud, and therefore, taking it into consideration, they still wrote what they wrote, and therefore, if there's any contradiction between the Bavli and the Yerushalmi, the Babylonian one, which is later and took it into consideration, is the most authoritative. So that's also because of the lack of authority. So one is the difficulty, because basically it was, you were looking at it as a work was written in shorthand. It wasn't written for publication. And second of all, really, that it lacks the authority that the Babylonian Talmud had, because it preceded it, and the Babylonian Talmud really was, which was the conglomerate of all the scholars, the Israelis and the Babylonians came together. So it has, it's the final, yes. It seems it was not a lack of trying. One of the great literary figures of the Middle Ages, the 13th century, of the 12th century, was Avram ibn Ezra, the great Ibn Ezra. He claimed that he was such a schlamazel, that if he would start selling candles, the sun would never set. And if he would start selling shrouds, people would cease dying. I don't believe it was a matter of lack of trying. It just was mazel. And he saw he did not want to accept charity. I mean, that's what it says. He did not want to accept charity. He wanted nobility of at least, it's a little, but it's his own. And he lived, you know. I mean, he lived a long life, but it was a difficult life.
We hope you enjoyed this lecture. For more information about this lecture series and to order our audio cassettes and the accompanying outlines, please write to the Jewish Heritage Foundation, 15220 West Lincoln, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237.